Hey, I'm Mike Stopforth, and this is The One-Eyed Man, a show where I talk to talented people doing meaningful work at the intersections of leadership, technology, and impact. As always, a big thank you to those of you who are return listeners. And if you're here for the first time, a warm welcome. My guest on this episode is Charlotte Otter. Charlotte is the author of We Need New Leaders. She's also the host of a very cool podcast called Speech Bubbles, but we're talking about the book right now. It is a bold and visionary piece of work that shows leaders from diverse and often underrepresented backgrounds how they can master reputation management as a bridge to career success. But Charlotte is also many other things. She's an executive communications expert. She's a two-time novelist. She's a poet, a journalist, and an advisor. She's run the gamut from high-powered corporate positions to coaching young, talented leaders into their next dream role. And it really was an extraordinary privilege finally having a conversation with her. In this episode, we discuss Charlotte's book. We discuss where it came from and how it came to being. We talk about her vision for a new dimension in and of leadership. And then we talk about practical steps for those of you who want to ramp up your leadership journey, regardless of where it started. I hope you enjoy the show as much as I enjoyed my conversation with Charlotte. On with it. Firstly, thank you for accommodating me, especially considering my technical failure last week. It is so good to connect, and I'm really excited about this conversation. I wanted to start with a little provocation, I guess. And the question I wanted to ask you is, what do you think most people think is true about leadership that you've discovered or identified or learned simply isn't true or is maybe half true? What is it that you've learned about leadership that most people think is true that clearly is not?
There's almost a sense that leadership is given. You know, if I think about people who are not in the corporate world, there's the sense that it's given to you or it's sort of like passed on like a baton in a meritocratic relay race. It's something you get. And what I'm learning through my interviews and the work that I'm doing is that don't have to wait for the meritocracy to hand you something. You can take it. You can decide you're a leader, whether it's in your community, whether it's as a solopreneur, whether it's in a corporate. I think it's the sitting around waiting for meritocracy to hand you something that might be failing people who don't look like the leadership norm. And I think what I'm coming around to saying in the book and also in my podcast is, if you believe it and you want it, take it.
So less about a title, less about a position in an org chart, more about a personal commitment. Is that a fair paraphrase?
Yeah, I think it's a personal commitment, but it's also a stepping outside, because you could make a personal commitment inside yourself that you're a leader and never tell anybody about it. You've also got to step outside, whether it's stepping up in your community, whether it's saying, I'm a solopreneur and this is what I stand for, or stepping up in your team, in the corporate that you're in, and saying, hey, I'm ready and these are the reasons why. So I think it's less about earning it, being given it, being handed the baton, especially for leaders from diverse backgrounds, diverse identities, or underrepresented minorities. The time for waiting is over. It's time to take it.
And your sense is that leadership is a skill, like a muscle that can be flexed and developed and stretched and grown following that commitment and following stepping outside. It's not like some of us are potentially born for leadership. It's not like it's genetically awarded necessarily. You believe that leadership is something that I commit to, I own, I step outside of my comfort zone, and then I flex that muscle. Would that be fair?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about flexing the muscle and about living it. And what's becoming clear to me is and this is where the reputation part comes in, the living it out loud is the way you show others how to do it. So I'm saying to leaders from diverse backgrounds and identities who have an ambition to lead, if you live it out loud and show others how you're doing it, it's much more than representation. You're literally creating a bridge for others to cross.
And I suppose this book then, the best way to think about the book is as a hand guide. It's almost like a step-by-step, how do I do that? In very practical terms, I think many of us, regardless of your political orientation, your economic bias, the geography that you find yourself in, I think all of us can agree that there is a sense, almost a global sense, that the version of leadership, our current operating system is buggy at best.
<Yes. laughs>
and it needs perhaps a vastly different mindset, approach, architecture, and your, and I think that sense is sometimes overwhelming because of the sheer size and scale of it. But what you've done with We Need New Leaders is, first of all, you've pulled apart exactly what the problem is in very understandable, very accessible language. But then you've said, okay, if you feel like you're one of the people that can move the ship in a different direction, this is exactly how you do it, which I think is incredible, because it's all fair and well going around broadcasting how important it is that we change, but not all of us know how to do that. What was the genesis of this wonderful publication? Where did it begin? What was the inspiration from the start?
When I left corporate in 2022, started my own business, I also went back to university, and I did an executive MSc in change leadership. And the reason I picked that course was I realized, coming out of a comms background, that all communications is about change. So no leaders ever get up on stage to say, hey, guys, we're here to tell you everything's staying the same. Leaders are always talking about change, and we live in a context that's always changing. So that leaders are leading in a change context. So having led change initiatives and the comms around change initiatives, I wanted to get a better understanding of it. It was an amazing course, 18 months long. I did a thesis, and my thesis was on reputation and how the CEO and the head of comms build trust to manage and mitigate reputational risk. And when I came out of it, I was talking to my professors, how can I take this further? The one said, oh, you could do a PhD. The other said you could turn it into a business book. And the PhD seemed too long and too onerous. So I went down the business book route. But in order to make it interesting for myself, I didn't want to write another comms book. You know, there are a lot of good comms books out there. Didn't want to be that person. And to make it a passion project, I thought, what could leaders from diverse backgrounds or identities or underrepresented minorities learn from the tools of reputation management? So the tools that I have to land, keep, or create their dream leadership roles. And that turned it into an interesting project for me. So I then went on to interview 40 leaders, emerging and established, all with different identities and backgrounds, to understand how they thought about their leadership, how they thought about their reputation, how their identities or their diversities played into how they led. And that was the genesis.
Amazing. I want to talk a little bit about the cohort of leaders that you selected to interview and the personalities that feature throughout the book. Right up front, you frame your commitment to a diverse base of interviewees, not just as a question of social justice, but as an innovation priority, which is a really cool line that stuck out to me right up front. And I think about this a lot, because I think, just like the word innovation, the word diversity in business has become a proxy for a whole bunch of other things that perhaps it should not be. And I'd love to hear more about how you think about diversity as an innovation priority. We can agree that diversity is important from a social justice perspective, but I'm really interested in unpacking your learnings around innovation as well.
I mean, lots of research shows that the more diversity you have in the decision-making spaces, the more innovation you're likely to get. But I wanted to look at the how, like how do you get those diverse voices around the decision-making spaces, and who was doing it well. And in corporates, it's important to hire, promote, remunerate, and reward inclusively. And that brings about some form of change, but actually it comes down to how managers lead and how managers show up on a daily basis to build inclusivity in their teams. And inclusivity isn't kumbaya, we all hold hands, we love each other. genuine inclusivity is genuine psychological safety to disagree and debate and have creative and creative friction.
Mm.
So it's quite counterintuitive on some level. We're going to get really safe so that we can argue. And when we can argue and debate and give genuine feedback, then we're much, much more likely to innovate and make change. Because what happens is people get really safe around a table, and then when the boss says something, they all just nod. And then they go to the water cooler afterwards and go, well, that was a terrible idea. I can't believe she said that. And what you really want is to bring the water cooler conversation around the corporate table.
Yeah. I tell the story frequently of my ex-business partner and I going through an exercise of a team building / personality profiling initiative for our senior leadership team. And we chose a partner who believed strongly in the Enneagram as a framework for understanding oneself and others. And I still believe it's a very powerful tool. And the first shock in the process was Craig and I realizing we had exactly the same Enneagram type and subtype, which explained why we got along so well as besties, but also probably explained why we struggled to navigate through some of the deeper conflicts in our business and in our relationship. But more shocking than that was 3 out of the other 7 people in our team also had exactly the same type and subtype. So what we were doing was creating psychological safety by employing people who agreed with us. So in other words, we were psychologically safe because we didn't have dissenting voices in the room. But the few people in that senior leadership team who didn't think exactly like us and who weren't necessarily fully aligned with all of our assertions and ideas felt, I think, particularly isolated. And if you can agree sort of as a flow of logic that the best creative solutions to intractable problems come from very smart people from different viewpoints contributing their best thinking collectively towards a common goal, then you can go, okay, well, how do we get the smartest people from different viewpoints together? And then diversity is a clear solution to that problem rather than being something I feel I must do or I feel forced to do or that I need to tick a box around. So I think it's a shame that most of the conversation around diversity and inclusion has been reduced to a conversation about representation. Representation is critical and important, but equity so much more so. I think that's really interesting to frame through the lens of innovation as much as justice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think, groupthink is so dangerous.
Yeah.
And you get groupthink when you're operating in a power structure and a hierarchy with a leader that is who is uncomfortable with feedback and can't deal with being told where they've gone wrong. So another thing that came up in my studies that was really interesting was the idea of leaders who are double loop or single loop learners. Mm. So leaders who are single loop learners see the problem, throw all the resources, fix the problem. Leaders who are double loop learners see the problem, throw the resources, fix the problem, because often it's a crisis, and then say to their teams, what was it in my behavior that caused this problem? And what can I do in future to make sure this doesn't happen again? And I saw so few of those leaders in corporate. And I think that was during my course, was kind of unbeknown to me, the light bulb moment for the book, when I realized leaders need a deep sense of self-awareness and self-knowledge in order to genuinely lead innovation and make change in the workplace.
I'm sure you've stumbled across some of the work that Dr. Robert Keegan and Jennifer Garvey Berger have done around adult development theory as applied to leadership. But this rings true a lot with that idea of the self-transforming mind, the willingness to entertain paradoxical ideas and opinions at the same time to make smarter decisions. But And even with the best intentioned leaders, one of the things that goes wrong is that we assume leadership is a little bit like how we would approach running for the first time. So when you take up running as a hobby, you've run since you were a kid. Like you in fact, when you were a kid, you never stopped running. You would scramble around everywhere, and it took you forever to stop running and just walk from one place to the next. But you assume that because I have run, I can run. I run well. And then you learn, actually, like when I run 10 kilometers, it hurts a lot because the way I'm running is inefficient, or the equipment that I've chosen to run with is not suited to me. Or so, you know, the moment you put a little bit of resistance into the system, the inefficiency of your technique tends to show up and cause injury and cause pain. And leadership's a little bit like that as well. I mean, nobody hands you a PDF guidebook to leadership when you're awarded that role. But we spend pretty much our whole lives trying to, as you said, convince the meritocracy to hand us the baton. But very few people, I think, once given that responsibility, think about how to continue flexing the muscle. It's almost like, oh, I've gotten there. I have the title. So now I'm imbued with this like natural ability to do this job. I'm interested in hearing about how some of the people that you interviewed evaluate their own leadership capability and what some of the tools are that they use to improve and make sure that they're staying ahead of their own shortcomings, their own technical inefficiencies, to extend the running analogy.
I love that running analogy. I think it's excellent. So the folks that I interviewed were emerging leaders of very young people in their 20s who were, you know, leading startups or were young managers in corporations, and then more senior leaders at the other end. Mm. The commonalities I found were extreme self-awareness, very deep self-understanding, and incredible intentionality about how they showed up, intentionality about the words that they used, empathy for their teams. We never really got into structures and how they got better, but I do think that's self-awareness and that preparedness to accept feedback is a really great foundation for growth as a leader. Mm. And you know, if I think about myself, the first time I became a leader, effectively quite late in my mid-40s, you know, it felt so uncomfortable. I always say it felt like I was given a coat or a jacket. I put on the jacket of leadership or a mantle, and it kind of didn't really fit. And it took me a good couple of years to kind of realize I don't have to wear this uncomfortable coat that's made out of a material I don't like. I can pick another coat that's more comfortable to me. So, but it took a lot of self-awareness for me to get there. To realize that I could change leadership, that leadership didn't define me. So I'm sort of thinking aloud as I'm answering your question, that I think that the commonality amongst all the folks that I interviewed was they realized they could affect leadership, that it wasn't a concrete thing that was handed to them that they then had. It was much more malleable than any of us realize. It was something they could own, shape, and change.
I suppose also, you know, the way we think about leadership right now is modeled on a system that has proven to be more and more inefficient in the midst of complexity. So, you know, if you Google models for leadership, or if you ask a generative AI, what does a leader look like? What is a leader in modern business? It's probably likely that those are built on a framework that is a little shaky at the moment. So it's the same as reading a running book from the 70s. You know, like, it'll have some good tips in there, and some stuff will probably be consistent principles, but we've learned a lot about biomechanics since then, and we probably need to reframe the way we approach that challenge. That's a nice segue, I think, Charlotte, into talking about reputation, because you spoke about becoming a leader relatively late in your professional journey, and you led in the corporate communication space, and specifically in helping your fellow leaders to effectively manage and navigate the realm of reputation. And you've identified, which I think is a really interesting angle, not just because I care about it, but because I don't think it's been done. You talk about reputation as being the primary lever for emerging leaders from diverse backgrounds to use as a tool to maybe like a key that unlocks the elevator that kind of gets them further down that road. I'd love you to talk a little bit more about why you chose reputation as the primary lens for how we develop this new crop of leaders.
I chose it because it's the world I've been immersed in for a long time. But I also was starting to realize and see that reputation is a power tool. You know, if you aren't seen, you can't be promoted. If you're not heard, you can't make the next step on the corporate ladder. If you're silent and you're a solopreneur, how do you get the next lot of customers? So it's not only relevant to corporate, it's relevant to anybody who's trying to build any form of business. So a couple of academics or books that I lent on, the first was Marianne Seacott's The Authority Gap, where she talks about how men are accorded authority in the workplace that women just aren't. And she has, you know, all sorts of research to back it up. But one of the things she says early in the book is you can't argue with a superb record of success. And I focused in on that word record. Now, the people who are going to hire you and promote you aren't recording your success. So you as an individual, the onus is on you to be the owner of your record. And the record isn't a list of all the wonderful things you've done that you keep in MS Word. The record is all the social media that are now available to us. You can now talk about the things you've done. And it's not just about boasting and I'm so wonderful and I'm humbled and I'm thrilled to receive this award. It's also the mistakes you've made along the way, the errors that you made, the lessons that you learned, the challenges that you overcome. All the stories that make you human, those all congeal or build together to build this record and this picture of who you are as a human being. It's much more likely to get you to the next step. So, you know, what I'm hearing and seeing is that for women or for folks from diverse identities and backgrounds, doing an excellent job is only 50% of the work. Have to be talking about it for yourself, but also for those who are following behind you.
There's two things there I want to unpack that I think are really interesting, because one is there's an obvious conundrum in there is that the right type of leaders probably don't feel all that comfortable talking about their record, to use, I think, what is a really powerful word. So it's almost like the person who should be the president is not the person who wants to be the president. It's that I'm paraphrasing there terribly. And then the second thing is, so let's unpack these separately. I think let me start with this. I wrestle quite a lot, and I think of this through the lens of brand communication and then kind of personal brand communication as well. There's quite a fine line between establishing an aspirational identity for yourself, who I want to be perceived as, and then making sure that you use that to as a North Star for the way that you conduct yourself, the way that you speak, the work that you do, whether you're a brand or an individual. There's a fine line between that and pretending to be something you're not. And the danger with pretending to be something you're not is that essentially your credibility is the gap between who you said you were going to be and what you were in reality. How do you think about a creative expression of your authentic self? Like, how aspirational should people be when it comes to presenting their leadership profile? Is there a danger there, or should you just shoot the lights out and make sure that you deliver as consistently as possible?
Yeah, it's a really great point. And what it speaks to is I realized, in the last few years that the idea of authenticity is actually contested, because you can be authentically terrible. I think being 100% yourself may not be advantageous. So that's one thing we can park. But I do think this idea of
toxic.
Yes. And we can all name leaders. But this idea of being over aspirational, I think, is dangerous because your reputation is made up of three things. It's your narrative, so what you say about yourself, your behaviors, and your networks. And this comes from The Reputation Game, which is an amazing book that I also lent on by Rupert Younger, who's the director for the Oxford University Center for Reputation. And so say you have this amazingly aspirational brand and you say all these incredible things about yourself, but your behaviors don't match up. As you pointed out, that's a reputational gap. So you really need to get the two quite close together. And if you get them wrong, your networks will make sure that the whole world knows about it in 24 hours. So called Astronomer CEO, Coldplay Kiss Cam, great example of that. I think there's no harm in being aspirational, but it's absolutely reputationally dangerous to say things about yourself that are untrue, that are inauthentic to you, and that you're never, ever going to be able to live up to. You may hold big dreams in your heart. I want to be president of the country that I live in one day. Hold that in your heart, but make sure that your narratives and your behaviors match, because that's, if they don't, there's the trust gap, as you say, the credibility gap, and that's where reputations die.
And in the second question around the conundrum of being, the types of leaders we need are leaders that are defined by their humility, defined by their self-awareness, probably in many instances almost erring on kind of self-flagellation and like, am I doing the right thing? Am I going about this the right way? You know, I often joke with my female friends and counterparts that, you know, my wish for you is that you'd be magically imbued with the confidence of a straight white male. But the challenge of being in that role is that often it by nature you are extremely humble in the best possible way. So how do you manage that paradox, the problem of needing to tell the story but also telling it from a place of deep humility?
Yeah, and that's something I do cover in the book. So what I say is, if you're in a corporate and you have ambitions to grow your career and you're already a leader, don't forget about the corporate communications department. So there are folks out there who can help you. So in a corporate, the corporate comms department, they want to build the reputation for the company. They need leaders who want to stand on keynote stages. They want leaders to author thought leadership blogs. They would absolutely love leaders who are doing actual storytelling. They would love leaders who are being vocal on LinkedIn about how they're helping customers using their product. They're also coaches. You know, there's a whole, the coaching industry has exploded. You know, spend time with a coach. In fact, a lot of the leaders I interviewed had kind of already done the work. You know, they had spent time either in therapy or with coaches and had that deep self-understanding, but also realized that by holding it back, they weren't helping themselves. So I think that there are a lot of people out there in the world who are ready to help you. So get the help and do it. Because as I said at the outset, you're putting the wind underneath your own wings when you actively live your reputation out loud. But you're showing the next little girl how to do it. You know, then it's not a mystery for the girl in STEM who would like to be a CTO one day. If you as a female CTO are talking about how you got there and talking about what you went through, it opens doors in other people's minds.
Yeah, and I think you combine that narrative with that track record of success, that's a very formidable combination for anyone. Again, regardless of their orientation or their inherent biases, it's very difficult to argue against that very potent combination. You spend some time in the book talking about the importance of the chemistry and the dynamic between the CEO and her chief communications officer, those two critical roles in the mix, both in terms of their individual aspirations, the business's aspirations, the people around them. If that's functioning at a high level, you open up new possibilities for leadership. And you speak in particular about developing or kind of deciding on new metrics for the quality of the relationship between the CEO and the CCO. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of those, like how do you think about metrics for success in an evolving age of both communication and leadership styles?
Yeah, so the The CCO is the only member of the C-suite or leadership team who is thinking about reputation all the time. So, you know, the CFO might think about reputation around about results, quarterly results time. CRO might think about reputation when they land a great deal. So it's a crucial relationship for the CEO. One of the challenges, and this is something that comms folks talk about a lot, they talk about access. So comms is a little bit in the place where HR was 20 years ago, where they're talking about getting a seat at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I delved into in my thesis, and it also features in the book, is the importance for the CEO to make sure that the head of comms has access to them, to learn their voice, to understand their business priorities, to improve their own business acumen, from the communicator's point of view. And that access can come in several ways. The head of comms can report directly to the CEO, because if they report via another C-suite member, that's two sets of emotional labor they're having to go through, two bosses they're having to look after. So reporting line is something to think about. Formal time, formal calendar time is really, really important, because if you don't do formal calendar time, then the interactions between the CCO and the CEO become tactical only, whereas the formal time gives you time to talk about strategy. And one of the pairs who I interviewed was the CEO of an Indian branch of a global company. She is Indian by heritage, but had returned to India to lead the company and was an unknown. And she and her head of comms made an extremely aspirational plan to improve her brand in that location. And they had, on top of all their regular meetings, they also had a formal long call or meeting once a quarter to take a look at the strategy, how was it working, what they needed to fix, and what they needed to change. Informal time is important because you need to fix those tactical things. You know, a crisis arrives, you've got to be in each other's heads really, really quickly. One of the challenges with informal time is communicators say, oh, but I've got the CEO's WhatsApp, like, I'm in their head, we're all good, we're sorting everything out all the time. If you don't have an excellent balance of formal and informal time, then you're only ever doing tactical work. And sometimes the career development of the CCO can be ignored if you're only ever working on tactics. And then there's this idea of proximity. So one of the most successful pairs I interviewed for the thesis, CEO-CCO pairs, were on different coasts of the US. But they had proximity because they had worked together for a very long time. And they had the time to build trust. So it was a form of psychological proximity rather than physical proximity. Yeah. And so that's what all those things are in the purview of the CEO. So the CCO can make a play for some of those things, but it's actually the CEO's call. So if a CEO cares about reputation for themselves and their brand, those are the four factors they need to consider. Am I giving my CCO enough time? The factors that are important from the head of comms point of view is, first of all, competence. Can I actually prosecute my job? Can I do this? And secondly, courage, because it takes a lot of courage to walk into a C-suite meeting and say, hey, this business decision that you guys have all decided on when I wasn't in the room, it's reputational. It's a threat to the business, and I don't agree with it. But you can't build that level of courage and trust if you haven't had those proximity factors.
It sounds like a rare combination. I mean, from my experience, generally dealing with in the agency and comms world, dealing with heads of communication, heads of brand and marketing as your primary client, there's a real struggle getting business to understand the commercial impact of reputation as a strategic priority, because it's never really thought about or put in front of all of the other really important business considerations until there's a crisis, until something goes wrong and the business is being accused of something on social media And it is remarkable how quickly communications becomes an executive level priority in the midst of a crisis, regardless of what the crisis is. And I've seen that over and over and over again. And you talk about this a lot as well. I think this is a key linchpin in the thesis around reputation management being a key lever for leadership success. You used the example of Liz from Amazon. She spoke about two examples of, you know, kind of crises in her tenure and how they were kind of make or break moments. And I wonder, how do you think about the role of crises in terms of a crucible for leadership? Because my sense is that you know, values are what you do when you don't know what to do, like when it costs you so, when it's really you're up against it. And I'm really keen to hear about your thoughts in terms of leadership and the overlap with crisis.
Yeah, I mean, crisis is absolutely a crucible, and everybody learns a lot about themselves and about the business in the moment of crisis. It can be excruciating at times. So yeah. All the folks that I interviewed, nearly all of them focus on proactive reputation management. And one CEO I interviewed described it as vitamins rather than aspirin. He said, You build your reputation proactively so that people understand who you are, that they trust you, and they know that you know what your values are, so that when the crisis hits, and it always hits, they are much more likely to trust you. If you're a complete unknown, and then you suddenly turn up and say, oh, by the way, you know, that milk that we delivered, that's off and our mistake and sorry, you know, your brand value is going to plummet. But if people know you and trust you and understand you because you've been available to them and you've done your proactive reputation management, they're much likely to believe your words and to trust that, you know, the next time around the milk that's going to be delivered is going to be healthy and good. So proactive reputation management is a insurance policy against future crisis. And one of the books I lent on is The Narrative Age by Frank Wolf from Staffbase. And Staffbase is a comms tech unicorn here in Germany. They build tech for internal communicators mostly. And he talks about this idea of a narrative moat. So we all know about the idea of a moat in corporate, which is, you know, the competitive advantage that you build. A narrative moat is the stories that you tell about yourself and about your brand that build a protective ring around your business for when that crisis hits. And that's where CEOs should be using their corporate communications team or their brand team.
Yes.
To be telling those stories and getting them out themselves, the individuals, the C-suite, but also the brand stories.
I think it's a very, very powerful idea. That idea of almost controlled burning, which it's because it's not necessarily doing so, but it's this, you cannot only tell the story when you're up against it, that the story is going to be filtered exclusively through the lens of everybody's worst perceptions at that particular point in time. And yeah, it's almost a sense that, you know, along with digital technology knowledge, along with strategic financial insight, the ability to build a brand and nurture a reputation is a fiduciary responsibility for modern leaders, regardless of who they are. And I think what I'm understanding better after reading your book is that the importance of that has been taken for granted because a lot of the leaders in the world that look and sound like me have had that narrative written for them. So you haven't had to work as hard to carve out the story, build the narrative moat, think about your role in crisis. Because it, as you say, for a lot of the people that are leaders that are like me, it has been handed down, literally. So that's a really interesting challenge. And I think a challenge for all leaders. So Charlotte, for people who want to dig deeper into your research and understand the practical elements that go into building their own narratives, building their own reputation and supporting their leadership dream job with that process, you've published We Need New Leaders with Practical Inspiration Publishing. Where can people find the book right now?
Well, thank you for asking. I'm so excited to say that I actually do have a book distributor and it's coming to South Africa. So it should
Amazing.
Be available in September in South African bookshops. Otherwise, if folks are feeling super impatient, they can buy the ebook right now. They can also follow me on Substack. So I have a Substack called Speech Bubbles where I write about reputation all the time and also about leadership. And I have my own podcast also called Speech Bubbles where I'm interviewing a lot of the leaders who are interviewed in the book, but also several others, really about that intersection of diversity, leadership, and reputation and how folks are living their reputations out loud, not only for themselves and their own fiduciary responsibilities to themselves, but for the generations who are following.
And because you eat your own cooking so well, beyond the podcast and the Substack, obviously you're active on LinkedIn. People can connect with you there, I'm sure. And even though X is a very sad place to be right now, I'm sure they can find some of your historical commentary and content there as well. Is that right?
Yes, I'm X of X. I'm on Blue Sky, but I'm finding it to be a little bit of a weird place. Blue Sky seems to be US politics and nothing else.
I must be honest with you. I am lamenting what Twitter used to be and the space it used to be. And I know that makes me a bit of a fuddy-duddy, but it definitely had a role to play. And it feels like that that space is no longer there. So I do mourn it from time to time. But
I do too.
Yeah, Charlotte, it's just been such a pleasure to learn from you and to hear about some of the insights that have come through what sounds like an incredibly rigorous research process, but one born out of passion and fun and just a genuine love for this topic and for the leaders that we wish we could see more of in those critical positions that are hopefully going to change the direction of business and society over the next couple of years. I look forward to listening to some of the episodes that are coming up on Speech Bubbles. And yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to be a part of the conversation today. Good luck with the book sales and hope to see you face to face soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike. It's been delightful.
You've been listening to the One-Eyed Man podcast. I'm Mike Stopforth, an entrepreneur, writer, and public speaker, deeply curious about discovering better ways to lead and better ways to live in an increasingly complex world. I find the best source of these ideas is the experience and wisdom of interesting people who are taking unconventional approaches to solving the world's most compelling problems. If you'd like to hear from someone I haven't yet spoken to, visit mikestopforth.com, click on the podcast link, and send through your suggestions. A big thanks to the Solid Gold Podcast Studios in Johannesburg, South Africa, for making this production possible. And remember, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man / person is a king.
You've been listening to another episode from the Solid Gold Podcast Studios.